I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is November 2nd, 2008. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today we're going to go over argument number 23 from the website of famed skeptic debunker Winston Wu. Argument number 23 from skeptics is the dying brain hypothesis for near-death experiences. Near-death experiences are simply hallucinations that stem from the result of a dying brain that shuts down in a way that produces those experiences. They are not evidence of an afterlife. Winston refutes this argument. He says, "This argument, called the dying brain hypothesis, is purported by many skeptics and materialists. Near-death experience skeptic and University of London psychology professor Susan Blackmore is one of the main proponents of this. Her book, Dying to Live, argues that the near-death experience is merely the result of hallucinations from the brain that erupt as it malfunctions and collapses. The main criticism of her work by other near-death experience experts tends to be that she dismisses the vast data that doesn't fit into her hypothesis." Winston, as always, you have it bass-ackwards. As a skeptic, Blackmore is trained not to dismiss data simply because it does not fit into her hypothesis. But that is exactly how irrationals think, Winston. The near-death experience experts you refer to are actually the ones who dismiss data in order to hold on to their unsupported beliefs. Winston says, "Kenneth Ring pointed this out in an article he wrote for the winter 1995 issue of the Journal of Near-Death Studies. Greg Stone, a near-death experience expert on my discussion list, recently wrote an elaborate critique of Blackmore's book in his article, A Critique of Susan Blackmore's Dying to Live and Her Dying Brain Hypothesis." Winston, we are not interested in what any of your little shower buddies have to say. It's what the scientists say that matters, and then only when they base their conclusions on the evidence. He goes on, "It should be especially noteworthy to skeptics that Ms. Blackmore herself, in response to Greg's critique of her book, admitted that her theories do not prove the dying brain hypothesis. Winston, it should be especially noteworthy to you that skeptics are the only ones who never claim absolute certainty. Absolute certainty is reserved for religion and for beliefs for which there is no evidence. You claim absolute certainty, Winston, every time you make a proclamation." Winston says, "This, of course, is a big blow to many skeptics and the psychop members who make such a claim on her behalf." No, Winston, it is not. No skeptic claims absolute certainty. Psychop members, as skeptics, are acutely aware of this. Winston says, "With her definitive statement on the record now, it should no longer be an issue. Here are her words. I have not claimed that any of my work proves the dying brain hypothesis. In fact, no amount of research ever could." There you go, Winston. She honestly admits that it cannot be proven. You are the one who claims to have absolute certain belief in the answer. Only irrationals have absolute certainty. Blackmore continues, "The most I could hope to do, and in fact what I tried to do in Dying to Live, is to show that we can account for all the major features of the near-death experience without recourse to such ideas as a spirit, a soul, or life after death." Winston, that is exactly what skeptics say about religion. It is impossible to prove that a God does not exist, but believers have never proved that God does exist in any of the religions. Since we can explain most of the universe without resorting to magic or God to fill in the gaps, it is unnecessary to add them in. Where would you stop? Why add in only your God? What about the other gods? What about adding in magic? Using the excuse that science can't answer everything yet does not prove that God is the answer. You need to produce evidence like everyone else. Until then, you have nothing. Until you can prove it, there is no reason why any of us should believe it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It simply means we don't have to believe it just because you do. Winston says, although many features of the near-death experience can be explained by neurological or physiological processes, this doesn't explain the message being sent. Winston, what message? Did I miss something? He goes on, in fact, the neurological effects could just be the result effects of the near-death experience, rather than the cause. Perhaps the TV radio analogy to the near-death experience helps explain this best. As near-death experience researcher and webmaster Kevin Williams relates, such reductionism, however, may only be explaining the mechanism of the near-death experience, not necessarily the near-death experience itself. In the same way, it is possible to reduce a television set to its basic elements, such as electrodes and tubes, but one cannot satisfactorily explain the television show being played on it using reductionist terms. Concerning the chemical basis of the near-death experience, and using this television analogy, if the brain can be thought of as a television set, then the near-death experience can be thought of as the television show being played on it. Science may be able to quantify everything concerning the television set components, but science is unable to satisfactorily quantify the television show being played on it. Winston, all that still doesn't prove anything supernatural. He goes on, there are several convincing categories of evidence to suggest that near-death experiences are not just mere hallucinations caused by a brain that is shutting down. These tend to be ignored or dismissed by Blackmore and others who support the dying brain hypothesis. 1. First and most importantly, there are many well-documented cases where the near-death experiencer, while out of body, was able to see specific details and hear conversations in other rooms and faraway places that they couldn't have known about beforehand, and yet upon returning to the body, find that what they saw or heard was in fact verified to be accurate and true. Winston, you are so gullible. Winston goes on, this is a phenomena that skeptics and materialists still haven't been able to explain away, no matter how hard they try. Blackmore herself knows about these cases and even mentions them in her book, but she dismisses it simply by stating that she doesn't believe them. Winston, you could learn a lot from this lady and her book. Unfortunately, that is virtually impossible because the odds of an irrational mind learning to think by using reason is rare indeed. More likely is that you will go to your grave defending all of your unsupportable beliefs in the face of any and all evidence. You will die, Winston, just as smart as on the day you were born. Winston says, this, of course, reflects the closed mental model of skeptics who dismiss facts and data that don't fit into their hypothesis. Winston, you've got it backwards again. You accuse skeptics of being closed because they will not accept your beliefs without proof like you do. That does not make them closed-minded. It makes them rational. Winston says, if near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences were just dreams or hallucinations, then these perceptions at a distance wouldn't turn out to be accurate. Winston, they don't. He goes on, the separation of spirit from body or the mind's ability to remote view are the best hypotheses that fit this well-documented data. Wrong, Winston. Without proof, they are not the best anything. He goes on, one famous example of this is the case of a nurse named Kimberly Clark. Talbot describes this incident in the Holographic Universe. Such facts notwithstanding, no amount of statistical findings are as convincing as actual accounts of such experiences. For example, Kimberly Clark, a hospital social worker in Seattle, Washington, did not take out-of-body experiences seriously until she encountered a coronary patient named Maria. Several days after being admitted to the hospital, Maria had a cardiac arrest and was quickly revived. Clark visited her later that afternoon, expecting to find her anxious over the fact that her heart had stopped. As she had expected, Maria was agitated, but not for the reason she anticipated. Maria told Clark that she had experienced something very strange. After her heart had stopped, she suddenly found herself looking down from the ceiling and watching the doctors and nurses working on her. Then something over the emergency room driveway distracted her, and as soon as she thought herself there, she was there. Next, Maria thought her way up to the third floor of the building and found herself eyeball to shoelace with a tennis shoe. It was an old shoe, and she noticed that the little toe had worn a hole through the fabric. She also noticed several other details, such as the fact that the lace was stuck under the heel. After Maria finished her account, she begged Clark to please go to the ledge and see if there was a shoe there so she could confirm whether her experience was real or not. Skeptical but intrigued, Clark went outside and looked up at the ledge, but she saw nothing. She went up to the third floor and began going in and out of patients' rooms, looking through windows so narrow she had to press her face against the glass just to see the ledge at all. Finally, she found a room where she pressed her face against the glass and looked down and saw the tennis shoe. Still, from her vantage point, she could not tell if the little toe had worn a place in the shoe or if any of the other details Maria had described were correct. It wasn't until she retrieved the shoe that she confirmed Maria's various observations. The only way she could have had such a perspective was if she had been floating right outside and at very close range to the tennis shoe. It was very concrete evidence for me. Winston, Talbot's book is obviously of biblical importance to you, so I don't want to hurt your feelings. Oh well, what the hell. Winston, you seriously need to climb through the mirror and join the rest of us in the real world. Living in a video game your whole life may be fun, but it isn't reality. He goes on. In addition, research studies back up these claims as well. One example is the experiment done by cardiologist Michael Sabam. Talbot describes this as well. Experiencing an out-of-body experience during cardiac arrest is relatively common. So common that Michael Sabam, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at Emory University and a staff physician at the Atlanta Veterans Administration Medical Center, got tired of hearing his patients recount such fantasies and decided to settle the matter once and for all. Sabam selected two groups of patients, one composed of 32 seasoned cardiac patients who had reported out-of-body experiences during their heart attacks, and one made up of 25 seasoned cardiac patients who had never experienced an out-of-body experience. He then interviewed the patients, asking the out-of-body experiencers to describe their own resuscitation as they had witnessed it from the out-of-body state, and asking the non-experiencers to describe what they imagined must have transpired during their resuscitation. Of the non-experiencers, 20 made major mistakes when they described their resuscitations. 3 gave correct but general descriptions, and 2 had no idea at all what had taken place. Among the experiencers, 26 gave correct but general descriptions, 6 gave highly detailed and accurate descriptions of their own resuscitation, and 1 gave a blow-by-blow accounting so accurate that Sabam was stunned. The results inspired him to delve even deeper into the phenomenon, and like Clark, he has now become an ardent believer and lectures widely on the subject. There appears to be no plausible explanation for the accuracy of these observations involving the usual physical senses. The out-of-body hypothesis simply seems to fit best with the data at hand. Winston, if Sabam's study had any validity, it would have been accepted by mainstream medicine instead of being only mentioned in Talbot's fairy tales. Winston continues, also significant are the studies done that support the validity of out-of-body experiences. Rick Stack describes one notable example of these in his book, Out-of-Body Adventures. A notable study by Osis and McCormick involved an out-of-body subject trying to view a target that was contained within an optical image device and could be viewed only from a specific location. The target was a picture composed of several elements. These elements were not physically together in any one place within the apparatus. If you look through the viewing window from a point directly in front of the apparatus, however, the various elements of the final target came together as an optical illusion. The out-of-body experience subject, Alex Tanu, was instructed to project into the room with the target, which was several rooms away, and try to view it. Meanwhile, the experimenters attempted to measure physical effects at the target location, effects that may be caused by the subject's out-of-body presence. They placed sensor plates in a shielded chamber at the viewing location. The sensors were capable of picking very small movements or vibrations, which would then generate electrical impulses in extremely sensitive strain gauges. These strain gauges, therefore, enable the experimenters to note very minute changes in the vibration of the sensor plates. Tanu was led to believe that the strain gauges were being used only for a subsequent task in order to reduce the possibility of his deliberately trying to affect the sensors while attempting to view the optical image device. Osis and McCormick thought that the out-of-body experience might be a state that fluctuated with respect to degree of externalization. That is to say, there may be degrees of clarity of intensity in the out-of-body state. It may be possible, for example, to be both partially out of and partially in your body. The investigators hypothesized that when the out-of-body experience subject was most fully out and consequently able to view the target more accurately, there would be greater mechanical effect caused by the experiment's out-of-body presence than there would be when the subject was less out and therefore less able to accurately view the target. The results of the Osis-McCormick study supported their hypothesis that ostensibly unintentional kinetic effects can occur as byproducts of narrowly localized out-of-body vision. In other words, apparently unintentional physical motion or effects can occur when someone sees something at a specific location while feeling that he is out-of-body. The strain gauge activation level that occurred when the subject was viewing the target and scored hits was significantly higher than when the subject scored misses. This finding lends some support to the concept that the greater vibration of the sensor plates was caused by some exteriorized portion of the subject's personality. Winston, you wouldn't be looking to buy a bridge, would you? Haven't you figured out yet that if this crap were true, these people would have been able to prove it to everyone by now? If they proved it to these researchers, why couldn't they prove it to the world? Why aren't they world famous? Every time any one of these clowns has ever been put under the microscope, they have failed to do what they claim they could do. You don't believe in coincidences, so how do you explain that? How is it possible for every single gifted person in the world to fail every time they are tested for real? Why do supernatural powers always disappear when put to the test? You said yourself, Winston, it can't always be coincidence. Winston continues, another notable example was done by Charles Tart, where a girl known as Miss Z was able to identify a 5-digit number above her bed in a position that she could only have seen if she had floated up there. Or if someone had told her, Winston. Winston goes on, second, near-death experiences usually result in permanent life-changing effects, whereas dreams and hallucinations do not. Usually, real experiences are what cause life changes, not imaginary ones. Near-death experiencers usually report that through their near-death experience, they gain valuable insight into the universe, about themselves, and what their lives are really all about, and how we're all really connected in a vast superconsciousness. Winston, you assume their insights are correct. Their valuable insight would only be valuable if it were correct. Otherwise, they were better off before they were enlightened. Winston goes on, many also report life reviews where everything they've ever done flashes through in a brief moment, and they feel the impact of their actions on others. which allows them to reevaluate their lives from a much higher perspective. As a result, many learn to love more altruistically and be less selfish. In addition, most near-death experiencers lose all fear of death, claiming that they've discovered that death is just a doorway, not an end. Winston, religious believers also see death as a doorway and not an end. Since 75% of America is Christian, that means that few people fear death to begin with. Skeptics don't believe in an afterlife, yet few admit to fearing death. We just accept it as the inevitable end to life that it is. If you need religion or a near-death experience to lose your fear of death, then I say go for it. At least something positive will come out of it. In other words, if you need a crutch to help you walk, then go get one. Winston goes on, third, people have had near-death experiences while they were declared dead with flat EEG lines on their brain activity. Any activity in the brain, even simple thoughts, results in some EEG activity. Therefore, it should be impossible, according to science, to have any kind of conscious experience while your brain shows a flat EEG line. Yet this has happened with near-death experiencers. Or so they claim, Winston. The EEGs prove otherwise. If they had a near-death experience, it was not while the EEG line was flat. Wake up, Winston. Use your head. Winston goes on. Fourth, some people have near-death experiences even when they are not in danger of death. Pediatrician Dr. Melvin Morse notes some of these in his article, Are Near-Death Experiences Real? The experiences do not only occur to dying dysfunctional brains. The Journal of the Swiss Alpine Club in the late 1800s reported 30 first-hand accounts of mountain climbers who fell from great heights and lived. The climbers reported being out of their physical body, seeing heaven, having life reviews, and even hearing the impact of their bodies hitting the ground. They were not seriously injured. Winston, it sounds like you are describing delirium. He continues, Yale University pediatric cancer specialist Diane Comp reports that many dying children have near-death experiences without evidence of brain dysfunction. Their experiences often occurred in dreams, prayers, or visions before death. One boy stated that Jesus had visited him in a big yellow school bus and told him he would soon die. Others heard angels singing or saw halos of light. Winston, there is nothing strange about the stories reported by the children. What do you think it proves? Winston says, The American Journal of Psychiatry in 1967 reported the experiences of two miners trapped for days in a mine. They were never near death and had adequate food and water. They said that mystical realities opened before them in the tunnels. They also said that a third miner, who seemed real to them, helped them to safety, but disappeared when they were rescued. Winston, again, easily explained by delirium. He goes on, In my opinion, the biggest and most comprehensive, easy-to-read book is PMH, Atwater's The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Near-Death Experiences. Winston, that book has your name written all over it. Winston goes on, In it, she writes of Blackmore's dying brain hypothesis. A parapsychologist at the time of her original work, but now focusing on psychological research, Blackmore has written one of the most influential books on the near-death experience, Dying to Live, Science and Near-Death Experience, in which she presents a detailed version of the dying brain theory. Her aim is to provide a materialistic interpretation of near-death states. Blackmore's theory is too complex to present in its entirety here, but the following is a summary of it. Anoxia can cause the occurrences of hearing music by stimulating the cochlear region of the ear, seeing tunnels, and seeing light. An inordinate release of endorphins at the time of death are the source of the euphoria associated with the near-death episode. The actions of endorphins and neurotransmitters cause such cerebral structures as the hippocampus to release stored memories, resulting in the life review. The sense of timelessness is the result of the breakdown of one's sense of self at death. the self being the basis upon which we distinguish moments of time. To respond to each of these points is not necessary. Instead, we can offer a rebuttal to the whole by quoting Dr. Kenneth Ring's criticism from his excellent review, from his excellent review of Blackmore's book in the Journal of Near-Death Studies. Does the brain state associated with the onset of a near-death experience explain the experience, or does it merely afford access to it? In other words, although many of the near-death experiences may be traceable to our body's responses to dying, does that mean that those responses explain the phenomena, or do they simply provide us with an interesting way of talking about them? There is no answer. Actually, Winston, Blackmore gave you a whole list of answers, but your preconceived beliefs prevented you from even considering them. It's odd how you can possess one of the most closed minds on the planet and not even be aware of it. In fact, it is one of the accusations you throw at others continually. If you want to see what a closed mind really looks like, Winston, go stand in front of a mirror. You'll never see a better example. And now we move to the science segment. Today, more physics facts. Measurements. A second is the frequency of radiation emitted by cesium atoms. A meter is the distance traveled by light in a vacuum in 1 over 300 millionth of a second. Nuclear power, fusion, when nuclei smaller than iron fuse. It is the source of energy for all stars and nuclear weapons. Fission, when nuclei larger than iron split. It is the source of all nuclear power plants. Neutrinos come in three flavors. Each has an antimatter particle: the electron, the muon, and the tau. Basic particles, the particles that make up the atom, that is, that make up the protons and neutrons and electrons. The first category, quarks. They form protons and neutrons. There are many quarks, including the up and down, top and bottom, charm and strange. A proton consists of two up quarks and one down quark. A neutron consists of one up quark and two down quarks. The second category of basic particles are leptons. They form electrons and neutrinos. And the third category are bosons. They are photons that carry the electromagnetic force, gluons that mediate the strong force, and the Y and W bosons. There is a predicted boson called the Higgs boson, which is a force-carrying field that provides mass. It has yet to be discovered. Quarks are held together by bosons, called gluons. And particles fall into two broad categories, bosons and fermions. If the number of protons, electrons, and neutrons that make up an atom are even, the atom is called a boson. If the number is odd, it is called a fermion. If two fermion atoms form a molecule, it will become a boson, because two odds added together will give you an even. The average speed of an atom is 2,000 miles per hour, and they can be stopped and trapped briefly in a magnetic field. Now the arena goes abroad. Today we go to Turkey, where famous evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins has had his website blocked by a court in Turkey. If you are in Turkey and try to visit Richard Dawkins' website, www.richarddawkins.net, you will currently find nothing but the note, "The access to this site has been banned by court order." Istanbul's Second Criminal Court of Peace ordered the Turkish Telecom to block access to the highly popular website upon complaint by Adnan Oktar, alias Harun Yahya, who claims that the site contains insulting remarks about him and his work. Harun Yahya is a messianic campaigner for an Islamic version of creationism who tries to expose Darwin's theory of evolution as the greatest fraud in the history of science. This bustling anti-science zealot has enormous funds from unknown sources at his disposal. That would probably be the oil money. He tries to spread his numerous books, articles, and films against evolution in various languages through the internet. In 2006, he produced a weighty and glossy opus of 800 pages with the name Atlas of Creation and sent 10,000 copies of it to scientists, journalists, media, and schools all over Europe. One of the recipients was Professor Richard Dawkins. The prominent evolution specialist described the book on his website as preposterous and noted he was at a loss to reconcile the expensive and glossy production values of this book with the breathtaking inanity of the content. Akhtar filed a lawsuit for damages of mental anguish in the amount of 4,000 euro against the Oxford professor. Earlier, Akhtar tried and failed to ban the Turkish version of Richard Dawkins' famous book, The God Delusion. The Turkish publisher was sued and acquitted. Akhtar's claim that the book was blasphemous was rejected by the court. The book became a bestseller in Turkey. Dawkins' book, The Ancestor's Tale, written before but in Turkey published after The God Delusion, was released and sold out in a single day. After the enforcement of a new internet law in May 2008, internet censorship is rampant in Turkey. More than 850 sites have already been blocked since then. Sites can be banned for various reasons. If their content is deemed to be harmful to children, to encourage use of drugs, gambling, prostitution, pornography, or suicide, to support the Kurdish cause, or to contain insults against Kemal Atatürk, the founder of Turkey, they will be deemed blocked. The video sharing site YouTube, for example, is banned in Turkey for 4 months for containing videos allegedly insulting the memory of Atatürk. For Akhtar and his associates, the new censorship law is a heaven-sent opportunity. Before Richard Dawkins' website, they managed already to get Google Groups and WordPress.com blocked with the claim that some groups and blogs on these sites contained libelous material. Akhtar is currently appealing against a 3-year prison sentence imposed for creating an illegal organization for personal gain. So the guy's nothing more than a common crook. Gee, what a surprise. And now we go to the final segment of the show, Famous Quotes. Today, the Augustine of Canterbury, born in the first third of the 6th century and died in 604. So he lived between 71 and 104 years. Either way, he got a full life. Augustine was a Benedictine monk who became the first Archbishop of Canterbury in the year 598. He is considered the Apostle to the English, a founder of the English Church and a patron of England. Roman Catholic bishops were established at London and Rochester in 604, and a school was founded to train Anglo-Saxon priests and missionaries. Augustine died in the year 604 and was soon revered as a saint. Now for his quote. What was God doing before the creation? He was preparing hell for people who ask questions like that.
Are you ready, Goose? Start walking.